Minnesota, welcome into the Friday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, the Friday before Labor Day. Here's what's coming up on the show today. In just a few minutes, we are going to be talking about a lawsuit that was just filed against Pete Stauber and Tom Emmer. Yeah, that would be two of our Republican congressmen in Minnesota. As the environmental advocacy group Friends of the Boundary Waters is alleging that both Stauber and Emmer's congressional offices illegally pressuring the Forest Service in regards to the Twin Metals mine that is being proposed in northern Minnesota. We're going to chat more about that in just a few minutes. Also ahead today, we're going to be speaking with Igor Volsky of Guns Down America, as we're going to talk about the surge of gun buying in the U.S. amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But before we get to all of that, I want to highlight something that's being proposed by the mayor of St. Paul, Melvin Carter. It is a proposal that would guarantee income for struggling residents in St. Paul with no strings attached. It sounds like a pretty radical idea, but this thing has been tried in other cities. I'll turn things over to Mike Moen of Public News Service, who has more.
This summer, a coalition of U.S. mayors joined forces to win support for the idea of providing guaranteed income for struggling Americans. St. Paul's mayor is part of the group calling for these direct payments that would come with no strings attached. Nearly a dozen mayors from across the country, including St. Paul's Melvin Carter, have pledged to seek such efforts, saying the pandemic crisis has only widened the gap for certain people and their ability to survive. Carter says gainful employment will be harder to come by as the nation tries to overcome the crisis, making it difficult for some to participate in a consumer-driven economy.
Over the long term, we'll run out of consumers if we don't figure out some type of way to ensure that community members can afford to live with dignity in our communities across the country.
The movement stems from a payment program initiated by Stockton, California last year. Carter says as a trial project, he would like to identify 135 low-income families in St. Paul to receive $500 a month over 18 months. Opponents of the movement question the affordability of these plans, while noting it doesn't provide long-standing solutions. Carter says he doesn't envision this being a long-term approach for the city. He hopes it will inspire a more broad approach at the state and federal level. He says this also can complement existing assistance programs that don't work for everybody who is struggling.
When we create these like paternalistic, super prescriptive programs, we spend a lot of money on things that aren't providing the best resource, that aren't providing the best help to those families.
Carter says families selected for payments in St. Paul would be connected to the city's College Savings Account Initiative. However, it's unclear yet if any other specific components to the cash payment plan have materialized and whether they would win enough support from the city council. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
So I think Melvin Carter actually makes some pretty good points. Remains to be seen if this system will ever be implemented, or at least getting the ball rolling in this idea of, I guess what you might call maybe a modified universal basic income, but certainly there are some differences between that and what is being proposed by Melvin Carter. All right, we got to take a break, but we're going to come on back and be speaking with Igor Volsky of Guns Down America. That's coming up next here on FYI Politics. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, happy to welcome back a familiar face to the AM 950 airwaves. It's Igor Volsky, who you might remember from some of our old afternoon shows with Ian Levitt and also Mike McEntee. Igor used to be with Think Progress, but now is with a new organization called Guns Down America. So glad to have you back on AM 950. Igor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, and so good to be back with you guys.
Absolutely. So tell us about this new organization you're with, Guns Down America. Tell us about what you guys are doing and what you're fighting for.
Well, we formed in 2016, right after the Pulse shooting in Florida, with the intention of pulling large corporations into the fight for gun reform and to make the argument to them that gun reform should be as much a business priority as climate change and diversity issues and everything else corporations now think is critical to their business. And the reason is fairly simple. When you see what happened at Walmart in El Paso last year, when you see what happened just a couple of months ago at the Coors factory in Milwaukee, the truth is businesses are impacted by gun violence every single day. And in the same way that business voices have been critical to helping bring about acceptance of the LGBTQ community, of immigrants, of mainstreaming the idea of going green and being cognizant of climate change, we need their voices and we need their megaphones to help us bring folks together, build the kinds of coalitions we need to really build a future with fewer guns and safer communities.
It's a really interesting way to look at it because, as you brought up, if you look at a lot of Fortune 500 companies or major retailers or really any major corporation, as you said, they've taken steps to be more welcoming of LGBTQ people, among other initiatives. And now, as you guys are saying, you're trying to get them on board with trying to reduce gun violence. And even over the past month or so with the coronavirus, looks like we maybe have a victory with what Walmart is doing in terms of trying to somewhat restrict gun sales. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we did a lot of work on the Walmart piece. You'll remember that tragic shooting in El Paso in August, I believe on August 3rd of 2019. That was an example of one of the largest workplace shootings in the United States. And when we looked at what Walmart has done on this issue in the past, and that is they, over the last couple of decades, have really minimized the kinds of relationships they have with the gun industry. We felt like, given this unique impact, given the fact that Walmart is the largest retailer in the world, the largest retailer in the country, that if they really prioritized gun reform and stepped away from gun sales, that they would be sending a strong message to businesses around this country, to other retailers, that gun reform is a business priority. And so we launched in August and in early September a multifaceted campaign in coalition with about 20 other organizations that staged rallies at Walmarts all across the country that urged individuals to deliver letters to managers at local Walmarts asking them to step away from gun sales. We opened up a channel of communication with Walmart executives about this issue. And we're so excited to see in early September, on the one-month anniversary of the El Paso shooting, Walmart announced that they would be dramatically stepping back from gun sales, that they would begin lobbying Congress on gun reform. And so it was a real proof point of the reality that if you push businesses and corporations in this direction, that because the public is on the side of gun reform and because there's such fear of having your most important corporate asset, your image, your brand associated with guns in the mind of the public, that you could really make some significant progress. And you'll remember that after Walmart made that decision, you had about a dozen other retailers that day or the day after or later that week announce that they too are going to be making some changes when it comes to guns. So, you know, we believe that this work is so incredibly critical to helping bring in the kind of voices we need to truly build coalitions to get things done. Because currently we're in a place where, you know, 98% of Americans support background checks, but we can't get that kind of bill through Congress. The reason is because you, I believe, is that you don't have the kind of voices you need to give certain politicians cover in order to support those kinds of initiatives.
And certainly Walmart is, that would not have been the company I would have picked to really kind of spearhead the effort for companies to try to scale back their gun sales. But that kind of shows that, yeah, if you can build those types of coalitions, you can even get a company like Walmart, which typically hasn't been very friendly to progressive causes, on board with trying to, well, scale back their gun sales.
Yeah, that's right. And I just have to say that that Walmart victory really pushed us to look broadly in the retail sector. We launched a campaign late last year called Business Must Act, businessmustact.org, where we graded all of the country's largest retailers on how far they've gone in keeping their customers and their employees safe from gun violence, and are going to be in the process of pushing those retailers to really go further. So folks could check out that site, could see how their favorite retailers stacked up, and can on that site there push them to go further.
Well, talking about building coalitions to try to scale back gun sales, one of the areas where we also saw some victories, of course, was in the Virginia state legislature. Now, as soon as they passed a number of new gun reform laws, we, of course, saw a number of protests in Virginia. And the perception I often saw in the mainstream media was that, oh, that the legislature is going against the will of what Virginians want. But as you guys posted over at your organization, Guns Down America, turns out a lot of these initiatives that were passed are quite popular with the public.
Oh, they're overwhelmingly popular. I mean, you look at what happened in Virginia. They passed five reforms that, as I rattle them off to you, you'll think, wait, these aren't laws already, right? So they expanded background checks to almost every single gun purchase. They reinstated a rule that you could only purchase one handgun a month. They said that if you leave your gun in the presence of a child, you're going to have to pay a higher fine. They established an emergency risk protection order system so that if a judge finds that you're at risk to yourself or to your family members, your guns can be temporarily taken away from you. And then there's another one that I'm not currently remembering. But the package of these laws were incredibly popular all across the state. You'll remember in 2019, Democrats ran on gun reform, took over, completely painted blue the legislature in Virginia, advanced those measures, and public opinion polls at the time showed, you know, north of 80% support for these kinds of reforms. And so when you hear the president, as he did just a couple of weeks ago, talking about Virginia taking away people's Second Amendment rights, that's a whole bunch of baloney and garbage, frankly, that's designed obviously to rally up his base, but has no real roots in the truth and has no real roots in terms of how actual Virginians view what was done in their state.
I'm not sure if you can answer this, Igor, but I know you're a good political mind. But before even Trump came into office or ran for president, I didn't think he was necessarily a progressive or a conservative or anything. So do you think he really even cares about the gun issue whatsoever? Or is he just doing this to, of course, appease his supporters?
Well, look, I think what we know about Trump is that it's less important what his beliefs on an issue are, and more important whether or not he believes pressing a certain issue button will activate the coalition he needs in order to stay in power, right? And what we know about the gun issue is that it's really the centerpiece of the Republican political coalition. That's something that began to happen in the 1980s historically. And so he's a smart political mind. And so he, you know, understands how to kind of juice that algorithm in order to really get people riled up about this stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, I'm not sure whether he really cares about the issue, but as you said, he certainly cares about rallying his base, and that's probably what he's doing by trying to say, oh, we need to liberate Virginia and get rid of these gun laws that are over-intrusive and things like that. And that was part one of my conversation with Igor Volsky of Guns Down America. Coming up on the other side of the break in part two, we're going to be talking about the increase in panic buying of guns with what's happening with COVID-19. That's on the way next on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Welcome back to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. So we're speaking with Igor Volsky of Guns Down America. Now, in the last segment, we were talking about some of the good news we've seen with organizations and businesses trying to, well, reduce gun sales and try to increase gun safety measures. Unfortunately, though, not all of the news that has to do with guns today is good news. So in this segment, we're going to be talking about the increase of panic buying of guns. So let's get back to my conversation with Igor. I want to move on to some other news regarding what's been happening with guns amid the COVID-19 pandemic. And you brought up some pretty shocking stats about the number of panic buying or the amount of panic buying we've been seeing with guns over the past month. And this is unbelievable as you compare March of 2019 to March of 2020. If I read that correctly, we've seen double the gun sales from March 20 from March of 2019. Yeah. That is depressing and shocking.
Yeah, that is both depressing and shocking. You're absolutely right. We began to see in early March all of these reports about folks lining up around the block at gun stores in order to make purchases. They were responding, frankly, to the fear of the coronavirus, to the fear that society might crumble, that police might not respond to calls as fast as they have in the past. And so what we know from FBI data is that we had about a million more background checks conducted in March of 2020 than we did in March of 2019. And even though there's no real data on this, what we believe anecdotally, at least, is that a lot of these gun purchasers were first-time buyers. And by definition, that means that they don't really know how to use a gun. They don't really know how to store a gun. And so what we're expecting, and frankly experts in this field anticipate, are fairly significant spikes in suicide, in unintentional shootings, in domestic violence. All of that is, of course, only increased when you think about the economic stress people are now facing as a result of this pandemic. The unemployment troubles, the mental and emotional stresses, and you connect to it the fact that in 48 states in this country, you've had reports of significant spikes in calls to domestic hotlines. That's incredibly dangerous. So, this virus, has killed, almost 60,000 people now in the United States. And what I'm very concerned about is that you're going to see, even after the pandemic is over, a spike in gun deaths that are related, sadly, to the panic buying we've seen.
And going back to something you talked about just a couple of minutes ago, the fact that most of these buyers, or a large portion of them, are first-time gun buyers or first-time potential gun buyers. And with what's happening right now with social distancing and restrictions on large gatherings, that probably means, well, as you talked about, they don't know how to store their guns properly, but also they can't receive the type of proper training that they probably need, being that you can't go to gun classes in public or possibly even go to shooting ranges. So, yeah, a lot of these guys are probably getting guns and having no idea how to use them and not even going through the proper classes to learn how to even use your gun in the first place.
And the other piece to point out here is that this administration has gone out of its way to expand access to firearms in the midst of a national pandemic. So the administration deemed gun stores essential in late March. In early April, they issued guidance that allowed gun stores to create drive-throughs on their property and to sell firearms through curbside service.
That's actually legal to do, a curbside gun sale, drive-through gun sale?
Yeah, so long as that sale occurs on the property of the gun store itself, the new guidelines that were issued by the ATF, which is the bureau within the FBI that regulates the gun industry and gun dealers, that they can go ahead and do those kinds of transactions. So, they did those two expansions, and you add to it, we've already discussed this president calling on Americans all across the country to pick up arms and liberate their states. that's a fairly dangerous combination. And you know, from what we've already seen, I just saw this morning, for instance, that suicide rates in Queens, New York, have doubled from where they were last year. You had the UN yesterday issue a warning that you're going to have millions more domestic violence fatalities as a result of this. I remember early on in the late March, there was a story out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, of a man who panic bought a gun, brought that gun home, and accidentally shot his 13-year-old cousin because he didn't realize that gun was loaded. These are the kinds of stories and tragedies we're going to hear about for weeks, months, and years to come. And the other piece of danger, if I may, is the reality here is that the guns people are panic buying today, the over million more sales roughly that we've seen in March, that some number of those guns are going to end up being used in mass shootings in our schools, in our churches, in our bars, because, you know, what we know from mass shootings, particularly in the school setting, is that about 80% of school shooters use guns they find in their homes to commit their acts of violence and mass murder. So yes, so this administration's actions, and, you know, the industry's efforts and the NRA's efforts to encourage people to panic buy, that is going to sadly directly result, is already resulting and will in the future directly result in more gun deaths.
A couple more questions for you here, Igor, but what has the NRA been encouraging people to do specifically with their marketing campaigns in terms of trying to get people to purchase more guns? I imagine they're not saying that directly. You need to buy guns to protect yourself.
Oh, no, they
are.
Or are
they actually saying that?
They are. They're directly urging people. Back in late March, they released...
Yeah, completely getting rid of the veil on that. Wow.
Oh, yeah, there's no veil. Yeah, the veil has fallen. in late March, they created a video with an African-American woman sitting in a wheelchair urging people to buy firearms during this pandemic in order to protect themselves and their households. That was really the beginning of the NRA's campaign to push people to panic buy weapons. Just last week, they published blog post giving folks options for firearms that cost $1,200 or less. And, of course, $1,200 is the amount of stimulus that families and individuals are receiving all across the country. they launched earlier this month a website called NRAWomen.com that's underwritten by Smith & Wesson, a gun manufacturer that encourages women specifically to purchase firearms during the coronavirus pandemic. So this is happening pretty overtly. You add to it the fact that the NRA has sued multiple states, California and New York among them, to force those states to reopen their gun stores during the pandemic. And so they really view this, I think, as a way to rehabilitate their image after, you know, headlines that we've seen over the last couple of years about corruption and overspending and possible violations of tax law. And frankly, the gun industry, which has been in a bit of a slump over the last couple of months, is hoping to use this pandemic to obviously get out of that slump. And for at least for them, for their bottom line, I should say, that has been successful.
One more question for you, Igor. We were talking about how the Trump administration has certainly been making some moves to try to loosen gun regulations. Have we seen any of that type of movement at the state or local level from state legislatures or even local communities, whether that's possibly trying to enforce more gun safety laws or trying to loosen them? What have we been seeing at the state and local level?
Well, what you've seen in certain states are efforts by local gun control local gun advocacy organizations to push states to keep gun stores open, number one. Number two, you've seen these same organizations organize reopen rallies in certain states and attend those rallies brandishing assault weapons. The real issue here is that over the last couple of decades, the NRA has very successfully urged and passed, frankly, on the state level, measures that make it very difficult for localities and for states to regulate firearms. And so we have, for instance, just this week, a case in Jackson, Mississippi, where the mayor of Jackson issued an executive order that would temporarily suspend the open carry of firearms because there's a certain danger associated with that. And now the attorney general of that state is pressuring him to revoke that executive order, and the mayor is now being sued because the Constitution of Mississippi makes it incredibly difficult for the mayor to take such action. So there's that kind of positioning that's happening on the state level. But of course, you know, the overall narrative, of course, they're using is that you need a gun during a period of national pandemic and emergency in order to protect yourself and your family. And we know that the research shows the exact opposite, that guns are almost always dangerous, but especially during stressful periods, they can be, incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, I've never quite gotten the logic behind it. You can't really shoot the coronavirus away. So I've never quite understood why people decide that they need to panic buy guns.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people, you know, for a long time, really for decades, have been conditioned by the NRA, by the gun industry, to believe that you need a gun to protect your family. And so if something goes wrong and somebody breaks into your house, you have that layer of protection. The truth is, and all of the research almost unanimously shows, that in very few cases are individuals able to protect their property with a firearm. And in fact, you are more likely to get out of a situation unscathed if you run away than if you brandish a firearm. And the reason for that is simple, because very few people outside of, you know, maybe law enforcement folks and military folks have the kind of consistent training you need to actually have a positive impact during any kind of confrontation. Usually what happens is that when you brandish a firearm in a defensive way, that firearm is often used against you, or you end up being hurt simply because you don't have the kind of high-level training you need in order to use it in that kind of circumstance. I mean, the fact that police officers all across this country have such a low rate of actually using firearms effectively during a high-speed chase or something like that should tell you everything you need to know about this myth that an individual with zero specialized training can be a hero during any kind of armed confrontation.
Yeah, there's certainly been lots of studies that have shown that that's not true, and I think a big reason why is that, well, if you do end up in a situation where you do have an active shooter approaching you and you have your own firearm, you're not sitting there waiting for that person to come shoot you. It catches you by surprise, and, yeah, you generally don't have time to get ready to try to fire back. And I think wasn't there like a study in Texas that showed that a while back where people were just better off running away?
Yeah, the study I'm thinking about was done by a Harvard researcher, a man by the name of David Hemenway, which, by the way, listeners should go to the Harvard School of Public Health that really has a terrific database of science on gun violence and gun violence prevention. There may have been one in Texas as well. I mean, all of them have been fairly unanimous in the reality that defensive gun use, while it certainly happens successfully from time to time, statistically, the numbers are just so incredibly small.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, that's Igor Volsky. He is with Guns Down America, and you can find more about their organization over at gunsdownamerica.org, doing a great job tracking what's happening amid gun sales with the coronavirus and, well, even outside of that, talking about how they're trying to build coalitions to try to increase gun safety measures around the country. Hey, Igor, really appreciate the time today.
Always a pleasure.
And stick around. We'll come on back and have more on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, the battle over the proposed Twin Metals copper-nickel mine within the same watershed as the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Area continues as we have a new legal development, as environmental groups allege that the offices of Pete Stauber and Tom Emmer, both Minnesota congressmen, have interfered illegally in Twin Metals' environmental review. So joining us to talk about those legal proceedings and what it means is Pete Marshall, who is the communications director for the Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area, as his group is part of that lawsuit that was recently filed. Hey there, Pete. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Brett.
So walk me through the timeline of how we got to where we are right now. Obviously, we've certainly been having a debate over the Twin Metals mine for quite some time with legal proceedings. So just jump us or just talk us through where we are right now and how we got to the situation where this lawsuit has now been filed.
Sure. So, you know, the big picture here is that there were these mineral leases at the edge of the Boundary Waters that were set to expire back in 2016. They did not get renewed because the Forest Service found that building a copper sulfide mine in this area next to such a delicate, watery ecosystem would almost certainly lead to an environmental disaster. So the U.S. Forest Service did not sign off on renewing these leases. So they were allowed to expire, and that was a huge victory for people who care about clean water, the vast majority of Minnesotans, and people who wanted to protect the Boundary Waters. Then, of course, we all know what happened in 2016. Trump is elected, and almost immediately the new administration goes to work to reverse that decision. And they revived the leases and ended up renewing the leases, essentially rolling out the red carpet for Twin Metals to proceed with their plans to open up a mine in this area. So that's kind of the real short version of where we're at and what this lawsuit involves. This particular lawsuit has to do with the fact that in renewing these leases, the administration, the Department of the Interior, namely, violated NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act. And how they violated it is that they allowed the leases to be renewed by doing what's known as an environmental assessment rather than an environmental impact statement. And I realize this gets into a lot of bureaucratic nitty-gritty and can get kind of overly complicated, but basically the Department of the Interior allowed the leases to be renewed after only through a very, you know, weak, toothless environmental review. And it should have been a much more stringent environmental impact statement. So the seedy part, though, is that we know that Antofagasta, which is the Chilean parent company of Twin Metals. It's important to remember Twin Metals is owned by a foreign mining company, that they actively lobbied to have a weaker environmental review. And in fact, at first they were asking to have a categorical exclusion, which would mean, you know, no questions asked, let's just renew these leases. But they even knew that would be impossible, and they said they would settle for an environmental assessment. So really the big takeaway here is that through lobbying efforts, they were able to cut some cut corners and get around some really important environmental reviews. And that's one of the what we're looking at with this lawsuit.
So talk about where Tom Emmer and Pete Stauber come in, because you allege that they brought in illegal pressure on some of these federal agencies to loosen or skip some of the requirements that Twin Metal would have to adhere to. Talk about how Stauber and Emmer were able to exert that kind of pressure to make changes with those federal agencies.
Sure. So what happened was that the Forest Service has a legal responsibility to weigh in on these leases, to either consent or not consent for their renewal. And they have a legal responsibility to comment on the lease renewals as well. Now, as I said, back in 2016, it was the Forest Service that stopped the renewal of the leases. They cited both public opinion and scientific evidence that these mines would very likely lead to environmental disaster. And because of that, the leases were not renewed. So we're in the situation now where, you know, the administration has flip-flopped and is now working in favor of Twin Metal's interests. So the Forest Service would have to do a complete switcheroo as well, right? They would have to say all that scientific evidence that we gathered, all the facts from the other copper mines that have leaked pollutants into surrounding groundwater, all that's not in that. All that we're just going to completely ignore, and we're basically going to cancel what we said, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So what Emmer and Stauber's office did was to put pressure on the Forest Service just to step aside, to essentially remain silent and not fulfill their legal responsibility. And that's exactly what they did. So that's where we have this undue political pressure to basically, you know, almost change the law, change the process in order to benefit the interests of this foreign mining company that is pointing towards a ecological disaster in the Boundary Waters.
And I think this is important to point out, because it is perfectly legal for politicians to obviously have input on a copper nickel mine or really any other environmental project that could possibly take place. But you're alleging something different has happened. It wasn't that they were just giving their input on what should happen with the project. You're alleging that they went all out and were actually exerting pressure on these federal agencies. So do want to make that distinction right there, that you guys are alleging this went a step further than just giving their input on the project, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, they're not, it's not your day-to-day, you know, meet in the bat in the cloakroom, have a cigar and some brandy and work out a deal. It's really stopping an agency from doing its job, putting the pressure on them to basically step aside. And you know, the proponents of mining always say, let the process work its way out, let the process move forward. But in this particular incident, and in many others, we see time and time again that allies of Twin Metal, the allies of copper sulfide mining, are really putting their finger on the scale and doing what they can to interrupt the process and twist the process so it works in favor of the mining company, even if that means it's work around the law. So really, it's not illegal for congressmen and women to try to influence agency decisions or influence policy. Of course not. But what happened here was that Pete Stauber and Tom Emmer, their offices, they work to basically stop the Forest Service from doing its job. They exerted pressure that stopped that, put a roadblock in the process, and basically told the Forest Service to step aside. So it's, in a way, they they work to stop the process, to break the process, and twist it in a way that would benefit the mining companies.
So what sorts of responses have we gotten in regards to this lawsuit from both of the congressman's office and also from the Forest Service Agency?
I don't believe the Forest Service has officially responded. Pete Stauber's office came out with a statement that, of course, he supports mining, that nothing he did was wrong. And I think, the usual argument is that we're, funded by wealthy outsiders, which is kind of a standard talking point, even though we're a very small nonprofit. So it's almost disregard disregarding this amendment that we've gotten from Stauber's office.
Gotcha. Okay. And how has Twin Metals responded to this lawsuit? Have they given any input yet, or are they kind of sitting back and seeing how this plays out?
That is a good question. I'm not, because this is going through the courts. I can't answer that question. I'm just realized right now this gets into legal beadworks that I'm not exactly, isn't my department.
Yeah, and both you and I are not attorneys, so yeah, we probably can't comment on that.
Right, right.
So that absolutely makes sense. What happens next in the process now? This has been filed, I believe, in district court, so we're just going to kind of wait here and see how this plays out. Is that kind of where we're at right now with this process?
Yeah, I think we're waiting for the Department of the Interior to file a response, because we filed, I believe it was end of April. So we're still waiting for them to file their response. So yeah, it's still making its way through district court.
And final question for you here. This issue we're talking about with the Forest Service possibly having illegal pressure exerted on them from both Tom Emmer and Pete Stauber's offices. This is certainly not the only regulatory issue we've had with this Twin Metals mine. I mean, we certainly have had other examples of federal agencies maybe failing to conduct thorough environmental reviews in regards to this mine. Just talk about, before we wrap things up, some of the other regulatory issues that we've been facing with this proposed Twin Metals mine.
Sure. I think, one of them that I mentioned at the beginning was that Twin Metals lobbied to get a weaker environmental review for the lease renewals, and that played out in documents received through Freedom of Information Act, and then played out in real life as well. There's also abundant amount of evidence in other Freedom of Information Act documents we received that, right away in 2017, when the Trump administration, moved into D.C., that Twin Metals parent company, Antofagasta, the CEO was lobbying higher up at the Department of the Interior to, quote unquote, fix this issue in Minnesota, to basically reverse course and help steer us, help roll out the red carpet for us. And there's been a lot of evidence that federal regulatory agencies that have been more of a friend rather than a check to the industry they have been tasked to regulate.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the coming months. We've been speaking with Pete Marshall. He is the communications director for Friends of the Boundary Waters, and you can find more information about them at friends-bwca.org. That's friends-bwca.org. Hey, Pete, appreciate the time today. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Brett.
And that's just about all the time I have for my show today. A reminder, with Labor Day on Monday, we are going to be playing some best of content, as both Ellie Krug and Matt McNeil have some great best of interviews lined up for you on your Labor Day on Monday. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Matt McNeil is up next.